You are about to enter the Shockwave Skull Sessions podcast on shockwaveskullsessions.com. And now your host, Bob Nalbandian.
All right, Shockwave Skull Sessions video cast, doing the video once again with my two great guests. We've had them on before. I guess this would be the third time. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
We're doing something very similar. So many great albums from the 70s that need to be covered. And we figured we'd pick 10 per episode, since we could spend a good amount of time, you know, keeping these episodes about an hour long. So that gives us, a few minutes for each album to discuss. But we got 10 new albums that both Bob and Horace thought were, credible for this third episode of what do we call this? Classic Underground 70s albums, something like that.
Sure, that works.
Yeah. So, we kind of randomly picked. I mean, we had a bunch of honorable mentions, but we, again, narrowed it down to 10. So, I think the last two episodes were both 10 each, too, correct?
Yes.
So, we're already on 30 records. And of course, there's so many underground classics, but I think the ones you guys picked were definitely some great picks, and some maybe not as underground as others. A lot of people say, well, what's underground? What makes it underground or not? But I think they're definitely underrated. Let's put it that way. So why don't you start? I know you got the list there, Bob, and why don't you start out with the first album?
Okay. So the first one on the list is Atomic Rooster's second album from 1970 called Death Walks Behind You. And I'm sure that Horace is just as passionate about this one as I am. And you too, Bob. This is a classic. It deserves to be heard a lot more than it is. It really should be thrown around on lists with a lot of the Sabbath stuff. They've kind of achieved that same level of doom and dread that Sabbath did, but coming at it from a completely different direction. Very keyboard driven, obviously, with Vincent Crane at the helm of this band. Phenomenal on the Hammond B3. This record could really sit proudly next to your Sabbath albums in that same category. It's not an imitation of Sabbath in any way. I wouldn't even say it was inspired by Sabbath. I think it comes to the same place in the end, a very similar place, but from a completely different direction, like I said. The music is probably inspired more by Vincent Crane's mental health issues, to be honest, than by anything Sabbath was doing. But really an early proto doom band. This record is where it all came together for them. Their first album was originally recorded without guitars whatsoever. Incidentally, Carl Palmer was the drummer at that time.
I thought it was recorded without bass.
No guitars. So the first version was no guitars, and when it was released in the U.S., John Ducan came in and played guitar on 4 songs for the U.S. version. By the second album, Ducan had gelled with the band, and they had really, really hit their stride there with their own sound. And it's heavy as hell. It's oppressive. The guitars really grind against the keyboards. Ducan's vocals are really kind of downcast and dour. The whole thing really, really gelled together. And again, if you're into that Sabbath thing, the early Sabbath stuff anyway, you really need to hear this. It's a fantastic companion piece to the first 5 or 6 Black Sabbath albums.
Yeah, this is my favorite Atomic Rooster album. I'm a fairly large Atomic Rooster fan. They later on became something very different from this. But the thing with this album is that it's everything that Mayo just said, but it's also really interesting because the roots of this band were in sort of English psychedelic rock, kind of like a band called Art, and these, which was the roots of Spooky Tooth. So I think, and of course, Vincent's real background was he was in the Incredible World of Arthur Brown. So he's the guy that's playing On Fire, which, has now been like covered by everybody from Bruce Dickinson to, I mean, it's been covered on numerous times, but
don't forget Moore too. The great
by Moore did a great version of that. So
really good.
The great thing about Atomic Rooster is, as brilliant as Sabbath is, you know, you understand the backstory. Geezer Butler and I think Ozzy and Tony Iommi coming out of, you know, Mario Bava's Black Sabbath and saying, why do people pay to be afraid? So they're sort of like, let's use this name and make scary rock music. So not a gimmick at all. It's like the greatest band in history, but there's a little bit of playfulness there. Now, the thing with Vincent Crane is the guy was suicidal. The guy was chronically depressed. All the darkness in Atomic Rooster is absolutely the real deal. It's literally a guy who is working through his mental health demons through his music. And, you know, there's stuff like Sleeping for Years. And, you know, Dukan was an amazing guitarist. So there's this weird mix of doom, psych. And, you know, it's a funny story about Vincent Crane was he used to get really annoyed when people would compare him to John Lord. And he would say, you know, oh, John Lord plays that honky-tonk crap. Like, that's not what I'm doing. I'm doing, like, something that's more like almost jazz or something. So he was very prickly about that. You know, that was like keyboard wars. You know, Ken Hensley didn't like to be compared to John Lord. Vincent Crane didn't like to be compared to either one of those guys. But this album, Death Walks Behind You, everything is perfect. From the cover to the sound to the songs to the lyrics, the imagery. It's just really, really dark. And it's without being out and out metal, it's very psychically heavy music. And Buchan's guitar really adds that very aggressive kind of, and that's something that they never had with anybody but him. I really like the first album, but it's kind of like, you know, amped up ELP maybe or something. I don't know. But the second one is where everything just comes together perfectly. And then the one after with Pete French is a very good record too, but it's still not quite as good. That's in Hearing Of. And then they turned into sort of a heavy funk band, soul band.
That's where the honky tonk kicks in.
Yeah, which is like a whole nother thing. But I think Vincent Crane was a restless soul. And I think he was a guy that he just, you know, couldn't stick with one sound. He always wanted to, you know, move on, try something else. And then there was a metal version of Atomic Rooster where Dukan came back in the 1980s, which was, you know, I forget what that album is called. I think it's just called Atomic Rooster. But they ended up cashing in on the new wave of British heavy metal, actually. They got it.
Oh, did they?
Yeah, they did. They had
a
resurgence. I think Mayo knows a little about this. So they did like that one album, and then they were sort of touring with the likes of Diamond Head. And yeah, no, they were sort of embraced by the new wave of British heavy metal for a short period of time.
Well, Bernie Torme was in that version of Atomic Rooster. So that was the new wave of British heavy metal piece right there that gave him that kind of cred to ride that wave. You know, I want to mention there's a song on Atomic Rooster's first album called Banstead. And Banstead was the name of a mental hospital where Crane had been committed previously. So we're not kidding around with this, with his issues. They were deadly serious issues. And obviously the end result, unfortunately, was his suicide. So this was serious business, and you can feel it and hear it in the band's music.
Yeah, I mean, this was a tortured guy, and he left behind a really, you know, our we all have a mutual friend, Monty Connor, who's a big Rooster fan for all of the eras. And Vincent, as a musician, and well, he was just a fascinating guy. And, you know, there's a lot of tragedy, there's a lot of sadness, there's a lot of struggle, but he really left behind a really interesting and fascinating musical legacy because he was battling his demons, but we were all here to hear it.
And what year did he commit suicide?
I think would have been sometime in the mid 80s. I think he reformed. There was the last version of Atomic Rooster around 1980. There was an album called Headline News, I think in 83. So maybe around 85 or something, but it was the culmination of a long series of, he was institutionalized a couple of times.
Yeah, it's interesting how so many bands.
Like Sid Barrett of heavy rock.
Yeah, I mean, I was just going to mention Sid Barrett, and not only that, you had, you know, Blue Cheer with their drug infusion. Peter Green, of course. And you know, later, you know, Bobby Liebling from, you know, Pentagram. That all that doomy kind of depressive music feel, that real heavy. But You know, all these guys, you know, a lot of it was you know, obviously drug related. Everyone was, you know, doing acid, had bad acid trips, you know, particularly, you know, Peter Green and Sid Barrett. You know, even Iron Butterfly had their issues.
And I think with Vincent, what it was it was a combination of brain chemistry, and he probably should have been on medication for schizophrenia and the other issues that he had. And of course, the problem is if you have those mental health issues, if you're piling on psychedelics and booze, and you know, these English musicians live hard. So, you know, let's just say he didn't have the constitution of Lemmy.
Especially late 60s. What year was this? What year was this? 69 or 70?
This was 1970.
Yeah, so it's literally, to all intents and purposes, it's still kind of the 60s.
Sure.
But that was Vincent. But yes, absolutely. If you're talking about proto-doom, proto-metal, you know, classic, early, heavy, dark, you know, if you're a younger listener, just exploring this genre, this is starter kit stuff. This is definitely on the first level. If you like Black Sabbath, you're probably going to like Atomic Rooster. And if you like Deep Purple, you're definitely going to like Atomic Rooster.
Yeah, it's kind of that in the middle. I mean, I think a lot of, and I think the reason that he kind of veered away, Vincent veered away from the comparisons of Deep Purple and Uriah Heep or John Lord and Ken Hensley in particular, was because they were much more proggy, not so much just really the honky talk. Like you said, the first Atomic Rooster was more prog, but I think they were leaning on this one more toward the Sabbath. But it was different from Sabbath because it had the heavy keyboard, which I thought is,
At that point, Sabbath were, you know, contemporaries. So, you know, the whole thing of being influenced, it's, you know, these guys were all grinding the same touring circuits. And, you know, Black Sabbath were not the icons in 19... Remember, in 1970, Sabbath hadn't even had Paranoid yet. So they were, you know, the guys from the debut, which admittedly was a bit of a runaway hit, a surprise runaway hit. So, but it was more a sense of competition as opposed to these are the big guys, we're the little guys.
Yeah.
You know, it's like when you read those stories about the new wave of British heavy metal and, you know, at one point, you know, Iron Maiden, Def Leppard, and Saxon, they were all on the same level. At one point, Samson were like the biggest
band. The big band, yeah.
And then, you know.
Iron Maiden had a huge opening. Yeah.
So, anyway.
Yeah, it's interesting how that works out. But, you know, it was something like I said, I think some of these bands, there was a reason why. And of course, like you said, after the second album, you know, again, like a lot of bands we talked about, like Montrose, you know, who kind of had such a killer debut, mediocre second album, and then kind of went a whole different direction. I think, you know, a lot of bands back in that era, you know, they tried to experiment and it just didn't work. And I think this was...
Yeah, well, with Rooster, they did Lucifer's pretty well friend. On the one with Peter French in Hearing Of. I mean... in Hearing Of, but it was a little bit of a fractured thing. I feel if they had made a more organic album all the way through with French, who's an excellent vocalist, if they had just done a full, because at least that album still had the heavy, and then they really started to they just went in a completely different.
Well, they had Chris Farlow replaced Pete French, and Chris Farlow was a well-known soul singer in the UK. Right. So they kind of followed where their singer was leading them, I guess, because they went full on soul. The last two records are very, very soul oriented and not heavy whatsoever.
No, that was late 70s by that time?
Mid to late.
But you know, a lot of those bands, you look at Deep Purple, you know, with Stormbringer and of course Come Taste a Band, they were going toward that direction too. So
little later though, because you know, Purple took their turn in 74, 75.
True.
72, which is when Rooster, they were definitely jumping out of their genre on the early side, because 72 that's Machine Head. That's
right.
Paranoid, that, you know, Paranoid Master Reality, you know, around that era. So
you think it was because they wanted to separate themselves from the Purples and the Sabbaths to do something?
I think, you know, Crane personally had a deep love of heavy soul. And I think maybe he felt a little straitjacketed by the heavy thing. I also think what Bob was saying, or was it you about the guitar players? You said it was followed by the singers, but I also think that Dukan, once you take Dukan out of Atomic Rooster, it becomes a very different band. Because I feel like Dukan is hugely underrated, by the way. But he's amazing, and he also went on to do hard stuff, who were also fantastic. So
we covered last time.
Yeah, but that's heavy stuff. So Dukan is not the soul funk guy. Dukan is the proto-metal guy.
All right. Right.
Though his roots are in psych rock. You know, I think he started in Andromeda, or like a psychedelic band.
Interesting. Should we move on, or was there anything else you wanted to? Okay.
All right. Let's do the next one. The next one I'm going to hand over to Horace. It's Sir Lord Baltimore, Kingdom Come.
Okay. So Sir Lord Baltimore are really interesting because they're kind of like another band called Dust. They're a real New York band. And they're really founders of sort of a really interesting mix of, this is very early in the heavy music cycle. So they kind of have this thing where they're sort of doing a little bit of Sabbath, but there's also some Jimi Hendrix in there. So there's kind of like the Hendrix experience at their heaviest, mixed in with a little Sabbath, and you have the sadly no longer with us John Garner on vocals, who have this really amazing kind of, it's a screechy but powerful, he had a very unique voice, very powerful. And the drums are good. And if I remember correctly, this is, I'm going to ask Mayor to help me out. This is a trio, right? This is a three piece.
Yes.
So, correct. Like, and Garner, I think, was also the drummer.
Correct.
Right. So you also have my favorite rare thing in hard rock, the singing drummer. I'm looking at
Grand
you, Spider.
Style. And,
just not that many other bands with a singing drummer.
Well, Grand Funk were one of the
Grand Funk, the originals, yes. And yeah. he has a fantastic voice. So you have a singing drummer. And so these guys were like a real power trio. Now, I actually have the HNE did the whole Sir Lord Baltimore catalog in one little box, as they want to do. So, you know, you could just
Hear No Evil Records for those.
Hear No Evil Records.
Yeah, great label.
That's run by Hugh Gilmore, right?
Yeah, Cherry.
Yeah, now, and Hugh does great stuff. So they had the self-titled album, and then they have the one that we're discussing here, which is Kingdom Come. And for a long time, that what was the thing? I think Mayo knows this. Did they flip? They flipped the album sides for some reason. And for
that, I'm not aware of.
People were, for years, were listening to the CD because the album was sort of rare, and they were like listening to it in the wrong order because it was Kingdom Come, which is the debut album from 1970. Yeah. So for years, when I first heard this album, I thought it opened with the song Kingdom Come. It actually opens with Master Heartache.
So the CD is sequenced different than the album.
Hugh Gilmore, you've now straightened out the track listing.
Yeah. Well, a lot of bands did that. I mean, I remember I had the original, the US version of Ace of Spades that came out in 80. And that, of course, had The Chase Is Better Than The Catch. But the English version had Ace of Spades as the opening track. And that always, and there
this
are a few.
Amazing. I've listened to that album 10,000 times and I never knew this. So what was the original opening track? I thought it was Ace of Spades.
No, Ace of Spades is the, well, when it was reissued on CD, they put it back to Ace of Spades. But the original US vinyl was The Chase Is Better Than The Catch. As
on Mercury.
Track.
Wow. Mercury. I've been listening to that album on CD for so long that.
Yeah. I love The Chase. I thought that was a perfect opening song. And then Ace of Spades opened side two, which I thought made a lot more sense. But there were other bands. Judas Priest.
Do every day.
Yeah. Judas Priest.
I've totally forgotten about that. I've listened to that album 10 million times and it's never occurred to me.
Yeah. British Steel. I remember Breaking the Law was the opening song on the vinyl, and then when they put it on CD, Rapid Fire, I believe, opened up.
Right, now that I remember. So yeah. back to Sir Lord Baltimore. So now we have it. I'm looking through the songs. Everything on this album is very strong, though I would say, you know, the real metal numbers are things like Hellhound and I Ain't Got a Woman. And, you know, this is just so 1970. You have a song called Helium Head.
That's a crazy tune.
Yeah, that is a crazy tune. And honestly, what Mayo just said further to that, one of the things that I really love about Sir Lord Baltimore is it's just a little unhinged. You know, it's like they don't quite know exactly what they're doing, but they're just going to go for it. And it's very creative. And I honestly don't find the record. I know when you're dealing with this genre, a lot of times people like it can be a little derivative. I don't find Sir Lord Baltimore derivative. They're doing their own very weird thing, which is a mix of sort of garage rock, heavy metal. There's some psych in there. And there really is. I definitely hear, like, especially some of the guitar solos and things, I'm definitely hearing the Jimi Hendrix experience, that kind of, you know, amped up wah-wah. And the record is fairly well produced. something in my deep recesses of my mind is telling me that maybe Eddie Kramer was somehow involved in this.
That's correct. He was involved with post-production. They did overdubs and mixing at Electric Lady, and he was behind the boards.
Thank you. So that would explain why I'm hearing a little bit of the Hendrix sound, because Eddie Kramer is very much the keeper of the Hendrix flame. But yeah, I would say this is not quite as essential as Atomic Rooster, but it's definitely upper tier.
I think it's mighty essential. As a musician, when I first heard this record, I had to look at the date it was released 5 or 6 times. I could not believe that this was from 1970.
Lucifer's
These record. Guys, it's the intensity level of the playing. Oh, Bob, you're wearing a Raven t-shirt, right? Remember, yes. Raven's thing was over the top OTT.
Yeah.
These guys in 1970, OTT. Yep. This is like extreme metal from 1970. They're playing together super tight, super fast, super loud. The vocals are nuts. There's some songs where he's doing the voice of like a character in the song. There are other songs where he's pushing his voice as high as it can possibly go. This record is a real adventure. Let me tell you. Again, Helium Head is the one. If I'm inspiring you to go listen to this record, if our discussion here is inspiring you to go check something out, check out Helium Head. And I'm telling you, 1970, who were their influences? This is really, I find it to be wholly unprecedented for 1970. That song and much of this album is just kind of out of nowhere, out of left field.
Yeah,
these guys were on fire.
What are they going to be listening to in 1970? I mean, in 1970, you're going to assume that they probably were really into Hendrix, because every musician was into Hendrix in those days.
Yeah.
Probably into some psych rock. Maybe they were really adventurous and they'd heard Blue Cheer and were into that. But for, you know, guys to influence them on the extreme end, it's fairly slim pickings. I mean, there's not a lot of, you know, there's a lot of blues rock out there. There's a lot of, but really crazy stuff. I mean, the Hendrix stuff is crazy on the guitar end, but, you know, Jimmy's voice is fantastic, but he's not like, you know, John Garner's one of those guys where you listen to him and you're like, is somebody squeezing his nuts? Like, what's going on here? Because he's doing, it's like the White Witch guy, except he's way better at it. It's this ascending, scaling helium thing where he's just hitting crazy notes. And the drummer was very intense. So it's real power trio music. That's the other thing. It's like,
let me ask you two guys something that I always wanted to know. As far as, I mean, I guess we're all roughly kind of the same age.
Yeah.
When you, you know, being from New York, bands like, of course, Dust and even, you know, Cactus. And of course, what we're talking about, I just forgot the name of the band we're talking about.
So we're Baltimore.
You know, being New York bands, you know, I'm from LA. And I know on the New York scene, it was a different thing. I got into these bands like Sir Lord Baltimore and Dust and even Cactus later, reading like through Cream Metal magazine. So we're talking late 70s, early 80s. I would go back. So I was already way into Deep Purple and Sabbath and Zeppelin and even Judas Priest and AC/DC by that time. So they never had the impact to me. Were you guys into these bands, these early New York bands, around the same time you discovered Sabbath and Zeppelin and Purple? Because it definitely will have a different impact.
A lot of the same stuff was going on at the same time with these bands, contemporary to the Purples and the Zeppelins and the Sabbaths in America, and maybe specifically in New York. But they just didn't stick. They didn't get the push from the label. Didn't push them. They didn't have a hit. Maybe they didn't tour enough. But they just didn't stick. They did a couple of records and then just kind of faded into obscurity. We didn't have the net back then where everything lives forever all the time,
right,
just a click away. This was, once a record was deleted back then in the early 70s, it was gone. And if you didn't catch it while it was in print, it's gone. So a lot of people missed a lot of this stuff.
My experience was slightly different. So because I'm an obsessive personality to begin with, you know, so what would happen is, there were things that I discovered you know, organically, which were happening at the time, you know, like the new wave of British heavy metal, demo tapes, Metallica, whatever. But at my intro into this, which has become a real obsession and passion of mine, this kind of proto early metal thing, is that I started reading books. And when, you know, these things would be mentioned in articles or whatever. And weirdly enough, one of them is a book that is not really a good book for this stuff, because the opinions of the writer are completely batshit in a lot of ways. But it's
I know exactly where you're going.
Getty, and it's Stairway to Hell.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. It's I thought you were going to mention Martin Popoff when you said batshit crazy.
Oh no. But actually,
friend Martin. I don't.
Yeah, I bought Martin's very first book, the one he's kind of disowned and refuses to ever re-release, you know, his original.
Oh, the Riff, what was it?
Riff Kills Man.
Riff Kills Man.
He's not here to defend himself. I love Martin.
No, I do too, but I just have to laugh. When him and Monty go at it, it's always fun.
Well, Mayo knows exactly what I'm talking about. So it was Chuck Eddy's Stairway to Heaven.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
And this is the book where he claims Tina Marie wrote one of the greatest metal albums of all time. I mean, this is not an Onion article. But sprinkled throughout the book, there were mentions of these arcane, strange albums I had never heard of, one of which we'll discuss later was Buffalo's Volcanic Rock. And Sir Lord Baltimore made an appearance in that book. And weirdly enough, my introduction to Sir Lord Baltimore was I would obsessively comb through used record stores, and I saw the cover of Kingdom Come, and I was like, it had cool song titles. It had a Spanish galleon on the cover. I was like, this looks heavy. So I bought it. And that I knew nothing about them. I took them home. The only other experience I had like that was the very first record I bought with my own money, which I was like 10 or something, and I didn't know what I was doing. And I went in and I bought Black Sabbath, Sabbath, Bloody Sabbath. I loved the cover. I had no idea. Never heard of Black Sabbath. Didn't know what they were. Bought the cover. So, you know, you can blame that album for making me what I am today. But similar thing happened with Sir Lloyd Baltimore. And then after that, I was like, what are these other bands? I need to find them. Bang, Blood Rock. And then, you know, it's like once you go down the rabbit hole, you just start reading and getting zombies. So
were these bands like playing clubs back? I know some of them, you know, they would open up for, you know, for Sabbath or whatever.
Yeah, like Bang got a tour with Rod Stewart. Awesome. Yeah, as crazy as that sounds. Remember in the 70s, a record label would put you for a little while, and sometimes they just put you on tour with some very strange
names. Yeah.
I think Ted Nugent played with like soul bands sometimes.
You know. Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's what was cool about, I mean, for me, I think what you said back then, a lot of those albums did go, I don't know if they were necessarily out of print, but they were definitely hard to find. They weren't promoted in the record stores, after the first few years.
And this was before the huge explosion in secondhand vinyl. You could find a lot of, you know, records in we had so many used record stores. We have no used record stores.
But later, I'm talking late 70s, like when the used record store, and that's kind of when I think a lot of people discovered them. And then magazines like Cream and all that would bring up. That's where I'd read about Blood Rock or Atomic Rooster or Lucifer's Friend or even bands from Canada, Max Webster never heard of. And
I used to get who are these bands? And I remember when I first discovered Repertoire Records. Mm-hmm. Anything in the catalog that even vaguely mentioned heaviness, slightly doomy, I never bat an eye. I took chances on bands constantly.
Now, what was the label Billings got that did all the krautrock metal? The first, they reissued all that in America.
The other quick story I have is that I had, it's like having a drug habit. So I had a record dealer in California who I would call up on the phone, and this is before the internet. And I would say, what do you got? And he'd say, well, I got this band, Tigers of Pantang. And he would play records for me a couple of seconds over the phone. I would listen to like a couple of seconds. I was like, that sounds cool. All right, I'll take it. You know, and it'd be like going down the list. And I'd be like, what do you got for me this week? And he'd be like, well, I got a box of singles. I got this band in here called Raven. Maybe I'll try. And I read Kerrang religiously. So I was like, sometimes I'd call him up and I'd be like, what can you tell me about this band, Witchmind? And he's like, well, I got a single. I got an album. What do you want? And then there were like, you know, import record stores. So I would go in and I was like looking at Tank album covers and I'm like, three-headed drooling dog, I'll take that. Stuff like that. So
that was the greatest thing about especially the used record stores back then. I used to go to the one down the street and I'd pick up all these used records. I'd come in or grab like five of them, go to the cash register.
Yeah, my
mother, the guy was cool. He's kind of a metal guy. And I would say, dude, could you play this for me? And yeah, I could tell he'd be annoyed. I'd say, okay, put the needle and play the next song because I want to see if it was good, even though it was like $1.99 or $2.99 used. You know, when you're a 15-year-old kid, that's a big investment. So I
was paying a fortune I was saving all my allowance money.
Sure.
And, my favorite story about that is I think it was like the second or third album I bought. I walked into a record store and they had, you know, remember they put the vinyl all the way up top spread out, you know, so you could see the album covers. And I had never heard Michael Schenker group. And it was one night at Budokan, the Japanese pressing. It was the most gorgeous thing I'd ever seen. And I was like, it had all those live shots with like Schenker and Cozy and everybody. And I think it was like $20 1982. And I was like, I bought it. I just blew all my allowance money to take that record home. And I was like,
my story is very similar to Horace's. We had a record store in Saugus, Massachusetts, which is just north of Boston. And I lived just south of Boston. And they somehow got every notable new wave of British heavy metal 45 and album.
Oh.
And I would go there once a week. It was an hour drive up through Boston. But I would go there every week with my paycheck from my summer job and spend every penny of it and come back with it. And I'll tell you one other thing about that Chuck Eddy book. A lot of people have that book. It's a very, at the time, it was a very valuable reference piece, but we disagreed with everything he said in this book. The only thing it was valuable for was the title of the record and the name of the band. Okay, I'm gonna go get it. Right. But once we listened to it, what the hell is this guy talking about?
It was a shopping list.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So that's what I used Cream for too. I didn't like Cream magazine. You know, we had one of the editors from the early issues on one of our previous Skull Sessions. I was laughing with them. It's like, I was a kid, I didn't understand, because you know they had, you know, this is before I understood sarcasm and all that, and they were very sarcastic in there, especially when it came to metal bands. They were all into the, this is when the new wave were just starting out and all that, and
they were I'm very fond of Cream.
I am too. I appreciate them now more, but I would just look if they said the word metal, and sometimes they go, oh, this is like heavy metal, and some of the stuff wasn't even that heavy metal, but anything that said anything like heavy metal, I would have to go check out. It was a shopping list, especially on the Cream metal issues. You know,
I had a very specific. I absolutely worshipped Kerrang, and I would.
When that came out, that was it.
Bob talks about driving the hour. I was in New York City, and I had a job all the way on the Upper West Side, and I would ride the bus for 45 minutes to an hour, sometimes just to buy that week's issue of Kerrang. And I would call the guys in the record store and be like, did the new Kerrang come in? And I remember just going in there and like Ian Gillan's on the cover, you know? And at this point I was feeling like really cool, because I'm like, I know who Ian Gillan is. And it's like, you know, Ian Gillan talking about Gillan, you know, interview with Bernie Torme. And it'd be like, they had these columns like Armed and Ready, demo tape bands.
I love that section.
They had this thing called WIMFM where they were talking about obscure AOR. So, you know, because Mayo's not into AOR, but I am. And it's thanks to Kerrang. They'd be like, you know, Roadmaster and all these weird, like, underground AOR bands. So, you know, anyway. But
Derek Oliver usually did that. Derek Oliver or Steve Hammonds usually did the AOR sections.
But I knew all these guys. These guys were like, well, I mean, I know who Bernard Doe was.
Now we're all on a thread together.
Now we're all on a thread together. Right, exactly. Yeah. So what's the record on our list?
Record number 3.
Yes.
Gamma One.
I'm giving that one to Mayo because he's the Montrose guy.
So if you followed Montrose through the debut, the so-so second album, and then the change in direction for the next two, and then his solo album called Open Fire, which is awesome. If you're still with him, you hit Gamma. And this was 1979. It was a brand new band for him. Jim Elsevier on the keyboards was on the last Montrose album, Jump On It. He was also on Ronnie's solo album.
And Warner Brother Presents, I believe he was on as well.
So he was at the tail end of Montrose and the solo album. They formed Gamma. And again, this is another really interesting record, I think, taking Montrose's pedigree out of the picture. This was 1979, but this is a really modern sounding record for 1979. It's not there's keys all over it, but it's not the Hammond organ. It's a new era. It's the synthesizer. And I know a lot of metal purists who might be listening or watching this, don't be scared. It's still a very hard rock record, very hard rock band. They just use synthesizers instead of the Hammond. I'm sure there's a Hammond on this record somewhere too, but it's very modern and very forward-looking record. Even Ronnie reinvented his playing and his guitar sound for this band. They really moved their band into the future with this record. I think it's way ahead of its time. And right now it sounds very dated because of those keyboards. So, you know, it's a double-edged sword. But at the time, it was really ahead of its time. You would think that it would be, we're describing a prog record here with all the synthesizer talk. But again, it's a very solidly hard rock record. The highlight for me being the double whammy on side two of Solar Heat and Ready for Action. They're kind of, they segue one right into the other. And that's the hardest, heaviest track on the record is Ready for Action. And Solar Heat is an instrumental with some great musical interplay on it. We have to mention Davey Patterson as well. Great find. I believe he's a Scottish vocalist. Ended up singing with Robin Trower for decades. He's probably still with him. But Davey Patterson was an excellent find. Very edgy, very soulful at the same time. This record, I loved this. I was in high school. I remember when it came out. I wanted to hear Montrose's new record, and I hope, please be like the first Montrose record. Please be like the first Montrose record. And it's nothing like the first Montrose record, but it's its own thing, and it has a lot of value. Now, jumping ahead to their second record is 10 times heavier than the first one, but it didn't make this list because it came out in 1980. But, and I'm a stickler for these kinds of details. We're talking 70s, we're talking 70s. So Danny Carmassi, one of my favorite drummers, is on Gamma 2, not Gamma 1. But Gamma 2 might be something that your listeners and watchers might want to check out in terms of what's their heaviest record. It's Gamma 2. But in terms of Montrose in the 70s, this is the one, I think it's his most interesting record, maybe beyond his solo album Open Fire. But I think it's a great record. Horace.
Yeah, I would co-sign on that. And I think anybody that did check out Gamma 1, if you like Gamma 1, you'll definitely like Gamma 2. And, you know, it's not a huge discography. They essentially did three studio records and then were inactive for decades. And then at the very end, near the end of Ronnie's life, he resurrected the name for Gamma 4, which is an okay record. And also, it's an okay record. I mean, I can't remember a song on it. So what does that tell you? I do have some residual fondness for Gamma 3, which is a very strange record.
Right.
It's, you know, Mitchell Froom is now on keyboards, and it's sort of like, you know, if Max Headroom made a hard rock album, it would sound like Gamma 3. But back to what we're discussing, Gamma 1 is a really fascinating record because it's kind of Ronnie's very, very heavy. It's not a heavy metal record. It's more like if an AOR band got mugged by a heavy metal band, you might wind up with Gamma 1. So you have like these sort of very prominent synthesizers, which actually sound great. And, you know, maybe it's dated, but it hasn't dated for me as badly as like the production on Def Leppard's Hysteria. There's something still very organic there. So I would say, you know, it's a very strong record. And I would say the strongest things on it are Ronnie's guitar playing. And I love Davey Patterson's voice. I think he has one of the great sort of gritty, I feel like he should have, you know, he could have been on a, you know, could have been on an album with Rory Gallagher or something. He's just got that really natural, the guy's just a natural. But yeah, it's a 70s album, and it's not as good as Gamma 2, but it's a very strong record and really a great example of the end of the 70s and the dawn of the 80s, because that sound would become like much more prominent as the 80s progressed. So Ronnie, as always, he was another restless spirit. You know, he was a little ahead of the curve. But it's also cool that Mayo mentioned Open Fire, which is one of the great unsung instrumental albums. So
not Open Fire, that's a Y&T you're thinking of. Open Fire, it was Solar. So what was a Solar?
No, it's Open Fire.
Yeah, there's two albums called Open Fire.
Yeah.
Okay, I guess.
Ronnie Montrose's solo album.
That's right.
You know, the bullet, the laser sight.
You're right. Okay.
So they're both called Open Fire. But it's one of the great unsung instrumental hard rock albums. And he does a lot of different things on it. There's some heavy stuff. There's some jazz stuff. There's some acoustic stuff. That's all in the way the guy played. I mean, you had like One and a Half, a little short instrumental, Lucky Man. He always did.
Well, there's an instrumental version of Town Without Pity on this record, and it's amazing. It was the single from the album, and it's an instrumental. But anyway, Gamma One, check it out. If you like that, you can go backwards one record to Open Fire or forward one record to Gamma Two. Right. But it's really definitely
go for three. But
three is a solid record, but the keyboards really took over there, and Ronnie's playing was very out there, which is a compliment. But it's not really a hard rock record.
No. I'll just real quick give my thing. I think, you know, when you said about Ronnie being a restless soul and very instrumental or experimental, I should say, and always trying new things, trying to get a new sound. It's like, no, dude, the first Montrose album, the production, Ted Templeman, that was perfection. Stick with that guitar tone, stick. Because, you know, I think by the time, you know, the Gamma record came out, there were some good songs. But you see, like, Ready for Some Action is like trying to be heavy, but the production, that guitar thin, it was like he was trying to be, like you said, a little AOR, a little new wave, because new wave was happening at that time, and it was getting to that experimental, you know, especially with the synthesizers and all that. And it's like, you know, it's cool, but it's like, I think he was always looking forward, trying to find the next thing too quickly. And he was doing that in the latter Montrose albums as well. And I think that's why he never captured the magic of that debut record.
I think also very much with Ronnie that there was a desire to be in control. And so he would sometimes run into personality conflicts when he had strong personalities like Sammy Hagar. And honestly, if he had been able to maintain, you know, a cordial relationship with Sammy Hagar, I think that would have been better for everybody. But, you know, I think, you know, when Hagar left, he just assumed total control. Bob James is a fine vocalist, but
he always had great vocalists, great players, like amazing players. Yeah.
And I think Gamma was more focused. Now I really like Gamma One, and it fits our rubric because it's a 70s album. But to me, Gamma Two is where everything
I agree.
Is.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree.
The sound works. I really think that Davey Pattison and Ronnie, they had really good musical chemistry. And I think they actually got along pretty well on a personal level. You don't hear a lot of stories about tension between Pattison and Ronnie. So maybe he's just a less dominant personality than Sammy. I don't know. But
unfortunately, we're also talking about the second suicide on this. We know we were dealing with a troubled personality there as well.
Yeah, no, that really, and I wasn't that also part.
And it was pretty hidden too. Not many people really knew about until the end.
Yeah.
I mean, as you remember, they said that he passed away from cancer, and then we found out later it was actually suicide. And then we found out about all the mental issues, and we kind of heard about, or at least me, I didn't follow it that closely. You kind of got traces about it, but you never realized how.
I think what it was that he was someone that was dealing with very severe, crippling physical issues that then led to mental health issues that then led to the suicide. I think he was having a lot of problems doing things. You know, another tragic one, of course, is Keith Emerson. And it was, you know, he felt like he couldn't play up the standard.
A lot of pressure for these, especially for these perfectionists like a Ronnie Montrose or a Keith Emerson.
But, you know, with Vincent Crane, I think it was, you know, the brain chemistry. I think the guy right out of the gate had some serious issues. It was never interesting. And that was an era where treatment wasn't as easy to get.
Yeah.
But, you know, very, very sad about Ronnie. I remember, you know, Sammy Hagar gave a lovely tribute to him and, you know, would try to call him up in the final years and say, hey, you know, we're all still alive. Let's get together and, you know, reform Montrose for a couple of charity gigs or whatever. He's like, well, we're all still here. So it is sad because Ronnie, Ronnie, like Mark Real from Riot, was just a great talent who just never really got.
That's another good, good one. Yeah. All right.
So the next record on the list, I'm going to hand over to Horace. It's Three Man Army, Third of a Lifetime.
Okay, so Three Man Army, they were one of the more later discoveries for me, but I was completely obsessed with that album because the cover is so crazy. It's the guitar stock that's like also a gun. And speaking of gun, Mayo can help me out here. Is it two or three members of the band Gun, the Race with the Devil guys? Is it both the Gervitz brothers? Is there somebody else?
All three of these guys came from Gun.
Right. So all three of these guys came from Gun. And Gun were very cool. We've all heard Race with the Devil. It's kind of like Inagata De Vida. It's one of those, you know.
Roll School, Black Oak, Arkansas, a lot of bands.
It's one of those heavy 60 songs that everybody just loves to do. It's actually one of the bonus tracks on a Judas Priest remaster. So that is the roots of Three Man Army. And I think their discography is hugely confusing because I think they have an album that's called Three Man Army, but it's actually the third album. Then there's Three Man Army 2, which is that the first album? So
no.
I'm trying to figure out where Third of a Lifetime comes in. Is it their first long play, or I think it's their second?
I think Three Man Army 2 is their third album.
Okay. All right. So at this point,
I can't explain it, but that's how it is.
Okay. So as to the musical contents, this is where they really started to, you know, get it together, shall we say. So the whole album is really tight. It's also 70s in the most hilariously sexist ways. It has this song on it called Butter Queen, which is you fill in the blanks. But now who's doing the drumming on this? Because the drummer on this album is phenomenal.
I don't have a name for you.
Yeah, I it's not one of the Gervitz brothers, but he's great. And Butter Queen opens with one of those. And, you know, just everything on this album just like cooks. And the other thing is it's one of those weird albums where there were like a couple of missing tracks and then they got put on the CDs. So I think I have five different versions of this. And I think I finally settled on the Japanese Fancy Pants SHM remaster where they supposedly put all the songs in proper order and you got the original gatefold or whatever. What was your first exposure to this one, Mayo? How did you even find this album? Because it was pretty obscure even by my standards.
I found out about Three Man Army through Popoff's first book. And the first one that I actually found was Three Man Army 2. And that's actually my favorite. And of course, for years.
Irving? Is Irving on that one?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And Irving is an absolutely kick-ass instrumental song, worthy of any of the bands that we ever talk about here, from the big leagues right on down to obscurity. Irving is fantastic. But that's how I found out about the band themselves. The first one I found was Three Man Army 2, and that's actually my favorite one. I went backwards and grabbed the first two. Where I found them kind of underwhelming. The guitar playing and the bass playing is excellent. The songwriting is solid. It's just kind of a little bit too middle of the road for me. The other thing that I will mention is that they really, really sound like a Southern rock band to me. They sound like the records could have been out on Capricorn.
Where are they from? But
UK.
Oh, they're completely British, yeah.
But man, do they sound like a Southern band.
Yeah, they're completely British with huge British credentials. They were, you know, they're also part of that band with Ginger Baker. What was that
Baker
called?
Gervitz Army.
Baker Gervitz Army. You know, the Gervitz brothers are pretty talented. And they're actually pretty active on Facebook. I remember once we were discussing some Adrian Gervitz is around. And we were discussing some proto-metal thing. And I was going on about this album. Adrian Gervitz pops in and he's like, yeah, that's my favorite too. I'm like, of course it's your favorite. You played on it. but yeah, I think I first heard this maybe in, I think it, Chuck Eddy again. I think it was in Chuck Eddy's book. And there was a period where I was obsessed with all of the sort of more political bands. And there was like sort of an anti-war song on that, which is Third of a Lifetime, which is interesting because they were a British band. But to me, it was like they were singing about Vietnam. Yes. Well, there you go. That was the that's the version of Pop-Off's book.
That's
that,
a pop-off.
The very okay, first yeah. one.
And that's where I heard about it.
Would like to bury and never see resurface.
Yeah. I can't make comment about the band because I to be honest, I didn't even go back to listen to this yet, but I do recall reading it.
Well, you think I'm going to like check some of this out. I think you would actually like
I will, definitely.
You would like Three Man Army. And I'm sure you've heard Grace with the Devil, but yes, Three Man Army. And then I had a confusing issue with them because at one point I couldn't find one or two of their albums. And so I bought one of those amazing Sanctuary compilations where they would do this thing where they would actually put an entire band's catalog on two CDs, but completely out of order. So I had this Soldiers of Rock, Three Man Army anthology, and it would go from like a Three Man Army 2 track to like a Third of a Lifetime track. So it was all like mixed up into like a big salad. And so I could never tell, like, finally, I had to track down the albums individually. And then I was like, oh, so that song goes on that album and that one goes on that album. So
what years are we talking they were around? Or is this early 70s, mid
70s?
Early
70s, yeah.
Early?
72, 73, 74.
72, 73, 74. And then in 74, they hooked up with Ginger Baker. And then you got Baker Gurvitz Army. And they had an album called The Legion Encounter, Hearts on Fire. They did like three albums. By the way, HNE to the Rescue again. There's a Baker Gurvitz Army box where they put like all the albums in one clamshell box. There you go.
Yeah, it's good stuff. It's blues rock, but it's solid.
But I actually like, I'm a big Ginger Baker fan, so Ginger Baker can fart around and I'll listen to anything that he does. So
right, let's move on. We're already almost an hour in.
All right, so we've got to move more quickly.
What do we got next, Mr. Mayo? Okay.
Next is High Tide Sea Shanties from 1969. I can start this off. Tony Hill, guitar player, lead vocalist in this band. Did anyone ever hear from him ever after these two records that he did with High Tide? He's a really great guitar player. Revisiting this album last week, prepping for this discussion, I was blown away again by this guy's ability. Now, this record in general is very interesting. Simon House plays violin throughout this record. Yes. Folks, you heard me correctly. Simon House later went on to play violin with Hawkwind for many years, but this is his first notable recording with High Tide. Now, you hear a lot about twin guitar teams and two guitarists playing together, harmonizing. Here you get to hear a violin and a guitarist harmonizing together. It's fascinating.
Pre-Kansas,
yes. It's fascinating to me. And the guitar sounds that this guy came up with, whether accidentally or by design, you know, it was 1969, so who knows what he was working with back then. But he achieves that Sunlight Studios death metal guitar sound, most specifically heard on the first song, Feudalist's Lament. It's a really remarkable piece. That's the song that I would suggest you start with. It sounds like the Doors on really bad drugs. This guy sounds like Jim Morrison vocally. He's kind of sings in a very low register. There's a lot of doomy keyboards. The guitar sound is disgusting in a good way. And there's a violin playing along. It's really strange stuff. You have to check out the instrumental as well. Death Warmed Up, 9-minute instrumental, guitars and violins working off each other. And all of that said, it's a proto metal record for sure. It's almost kind of in that Death Walks Behind You kind of doomy, dirgy feel to it. Now, all of that said, all of that was positive, right? I actually find this record to be unlistenable. Can never make it to the end. Yes, after all that. It's interesting. It's fascinating. It's historically notable. It's important. I don't like it. I don't enjoy it.
What about you, Boris?
I'll be really brief on this album. I love this album, and I listen to it fairly regularly. And for me, the key track is Death Warmed Up. And this, to me, is one of the most unhinged bands I've ever heard. It's just reeks of like evil psychedelic drugs. So it's like these guys are on some really good shit, and I don't know what the hell is going on in this band. And I remember the guy that introduced me to them was a British musician. He was a guy named Stephen Bailey. And Steve Bailey's claim to fame was that he's the drummer on the second Starfighters album. And he was a friend of mine. And he used to tell great stories because Starfighters were once on tour with the Michael Schenker group. And he used to tell stories about Cozy Powell throwing a full plate of sausage and beans at Michael Schenker's head because he wouldn't take Michael's crap. So he had all these great stories, and he loved this record, and he knew nothing about it. He knew nothing about the musicians. I said, what's the story on these guys? Like, when did they come? He's like, I have no idea. I just love this record. And so I he's like, listen to it. And he's like, it's like, I said, what does it sound like? He said, I can't describe it. Just listen to it. And I was like, I can't describe it either. It's just too weird. I don't know. Maybe Hawkwind, if they were trying to play heavy metal with a violin player. I don't know. But the whole thing is just crazy. And there is something about violins when you mesh them with heavy rock. And it doesn't happen very often. You know, I think Kansas did it a little bit. It's fantastic when they do it. Yeah. And there's a violin on a couple of Golden Earring songs. Yeah. I think the song Violins by Golden Earring has a little violin action in it. So I love it. But yeah, this is just
bizarre.
Yeah. Open up your mind, man, and drop some psychedelic mushrooms and check it out. But this is very much a love it or hate it.
I could hear the Unlistenable. I was not familiar with the band back in the day. I think in one of the threads, one of you guys sent a link, maybe, or somebody. I heard it from a YouTube thing, and I got through maybe 3-4 minutes. It's like, oh, this is heavy. This is interesting, but it's not for me, kind of thing.
Yeah, no. Yeah. Understood. Yeah. So what's our next one?
Okay, next one is Quartz.
Ah, great. One of the original new wave of British heavy metal bands, if you want to call them that. Because they were actually pre 79, right? What year was this?
77. Album? 77.
Yeah.
Quartz, yeah. I'll run fast on this. So Quartz are fascinating because they're, where do you put them? They were later widely embraced by the new wave of British heavy metal, but they are way too early, really, to be new wave of British heavy metal. They're a 70s band, and of course, massive Black Sabbath connections. First album produced by Tony Iommi. This is the band that gave us Jeff Nichols, who, you know, was the sort of hidden Sabbath member that, you know, they didn't treat all that well. But he worked with them for years.
Yeah.
And, you know, fascinating guy. But that first Quartz album, which I think also had the rather funny title of Deleted, was its alternate title.
Well, because it came out in 77 on Jet.
Right.
Did nothing, was deleted. And when the new wave of British heavy metal hit, boom, they re-released it with a new cover and a new title. Because what other record happened in 1980 that had Tony Iommi on it?
Heaven and Hell.
And what's the name of the first song on this
Main
record?
Main Line Riders.
And what song does that sound very totally reminiscent of?
Absolutely. Yeah.
There's a connection there. So that's why it was re-released with a different.
What a great tune, especially for 77 too. Great production, great tune. I mean, Tony Iommi did a fantastic job, and you could hear, this was, you know, way before Sabbath had Dio in the band, and you could hear that kind of Dio influence. I don't know if they were influenced by Rainbow, but it almost, you know, led into that Heaven and Hell.
And it's really well produced and
very well.
So the other band that Tony worked with, Necromandus, isn't nearly as good. So it's strange stuff. But, you know, Quartz to me were always just fascinating. It was sort of like, you know, the buried relic. And another band that it was difficult to figure out the track listings and the song titles. It was another band that, you know, in the CD age got anthologized to death with, you know, with this sort of, you know, mix and match kind of compilations that would throw together various things. There was a live album.
Yeah, I think Metal Blade put out an album that had some live. Yeah.
Well, there's the real full-on Quartz new wave of British heavy metal album, which is Against All Odds, which has the chainmail wielding warrior. But the first album is very much, I would say, essential listening for, you know, fans of Sabbath. If you, you know, want a little bit of doom, new wave of British heavy metal, very early aficionados of that sound. Though I wouldn't really call it I wonder what Mayo thinks on this. I wouldn't really say it has a new wave of British heavy metal sound. I think
I would agree with you there. I think the first song, because of its obvious Sabbath connection, mm-hmm. and the sound alike quality of it as well, is notable. But I find the rest of the record to be very pedestrian, to be honest with you. It's a solid debut for a British band from 1977, you know, before anything significant, that wave that was coming crested. Beyond that one song, I really didn't find anything notable on this record. And I think really what's holding it back is the vocalist. They really lack a strong vocalist with a strong personality. They probably sound like 100 other bands playing the pubs in 1977 in the UK. Don't know how they got connected up with Tony Iommi, but that was a real lucky break for them, because that one song is the outstanding piece on the record.
Being 77, this was early on. This was in the middle of when the punk movement just broke in England, which was huge. So you weren't seeing any metal bands. You know, maybe Budgie were still, as far as you could call them, a newer metal band. But you had the classic rock, classic metal bands that, you know, people were kind of getting sick of, all the prog bands people were getting sick of. This album comes out of nowhere, right in the midst of, and, you know, you had bands like Maiden and even Raven here, you know, around since 74. None of those bands could get deals back then, or there was no interest in hard rock and metal. Like
Strife, you know, Blythe, the Boat Club.
Priest was out there in 77.
They were out before, though. They came out. I mean, they had albums out, so they were kind of leading up to that. But you're right. And of course, Thin Lizzy and bands like that. And then you had AC/DC that came out, in 77, they came out with one of their heaviest albums, Let There Be Rock, which was more thrown into the punk category. You could kind of, it was kind of liked by both. You know, people didn't know what.
Well, at that point, I think AC/DC were still in Australia, or had they moved to the UK?
No, but they did a lot of touring in the UK. I think that at that time, they really tried to break.
Yeah, in 76, they came to the UK.
Yeah.
In 76.
Really a part of that. And they were getting a lot of the punk stuff going. But you're right. Quartz is very hard rock. It's very mainstream. Not new wave of British heavy metal, but it's a good hard rock record. I enjoy that record. But you're right. Mainline Riders, definitely the key song. All right, who's getting arrested here? Is that Horace or Bob?
It's New York City. We randomly hear, sirens coming out of nowhere.
I remember living in Hollywood, that the sweet sound of silent sirens and helicopters. Yes.
Yep, there you go. What's our next one?
Next one is Buffalo Volcanic Rock, 1973.
So this is the Australian band, not to be confused with the new wave of British heavy metal band, Buffalo.
Correct.
I'll go on this one.
Go for it.
So Buffalo, who I just love, and I actually interact with Dave Tice fairly regularly on Facebook, the vocalist. Buffalo, this one is completely laid at the door of Chuck Eddy, because I had never heard anything about this band until I saw this album discussed in that book.
And same me.
It has an all red cover, like with a some sort of Promethean figure with a big dick exploding out of lava. I mean, you look at the album cover and you're like, this is just, if you look up cock rock in the dictionary, there it is. I'm like, this, you couldn't be more blatant. Every song has some, song about, sunrise and then Shylock. And, it's all this sort of like these heavy topics. There are things in proto metal and early metal where people are like, it doesn't quite live up to, it looks heavier than it is or whatever. I think this album is for the time very heavy. And I think there's some that the opening song, Sunrise brackets Come My Way, has this really blazing fast, kind of faster riff. And it's a real barnstormer. So it opens very strong. And then, there's just some long, very heavy kind of pounding tracks. This, by the way, was their second album. They had an album before this called Dead Forever, which is a little bit more lumbering, though I like it a lot, but it's a little bit more psychedelic. It's a little bit more lumbering. This is the album where they're really trying to get heavy. And all of the songs are fairly long. And I just, it's an album that I can re-listen to over and over and never really get tired of. And they were heavy for their time, especially for Australia. So to put it in perspective, they were Black Sabbath's opening act on their Australian tour of 1975. So if you went to see Black Sabbath in Sydney in 1975, Buffalo were the openers. And they were also a Vertigo band. So they were, you know, there were some Sabbath connections there as well. But it's pretty heavy stuff as far as I'm concerned. It's not the fastest, but it's heavy. And also the vocals are very rough.
I actually think that this singer, Dave Tice, is fantastic. The second song on the record is called Freedom. And I hear Chris Cornell through that whole song. And that is a high praise indeed. I think he really, I'm not going to say he channels Chris Cornell. Obviously, that's chronologically, that doesn't work. But really, if you bend your imagination just a tiny bit, it sounds an awful lot like Chris Cornell. He's at that same level of feel. And the notes as well. He's got the same range as Cornell. When he wants to pull it out, it's there. It's very earthy production. It's very live, kind of garagey, stripped down, basic, no frills, as it happens kind of a band. Kind of like a louder, heavier Free, in my opinion. It's not, there's no bells and whistles. It's just four guys doing their thing in your face. Very laid back grooves a la Free, very stripped down and simple arrangements, but it's loud. It's aggressive. When I first heard this record, I found it from Chuck Eddy's book as well. So thank you, Martin, and thank you, Chuck. When I first heard this record, I wasn't a fan. I didn't like it. Over the years, it has really grown on me because people continue to plug it, and I continue to listen to it. And after noting the comparisons to Cornell and to Free, I think this was a really overlooked gem of a record. And I bet that it inspired Soundgarden. I wouldn't be surprised to find that somebody in Soundgarden had this record in their collection. It's got that same kind of vibe to it. So this is one that I highly recommend. It took a while to grow on me, but I really dig it.
Very cool.
Yeah, I first got it on the old Second Battle CD, which, it took me a long time to find it. And I think it was, it was one of those albums that I had checked off on my list of, because I wasn't buying vinyl at that point, I was buying CDs. I had it checked off on my list of, if this ever gets a CD reissue, I'm all over.
Yeah, I wasn't aware of this band until way later. I always thought AC/DC were the original Australian band, AC/DC, then the Angels, and then Rose Tattoo, growing up.
That's, no, you and also then forgot, way later. Angry Anderson's first band, Buster Brown.
Right. Well, I wasn't familiar with them then. I was, living here in the States, and we got the records here. And, then you backtrack. I think I probably found out about Buffalo in the early 90s, maybe. And, which is interesting. Were there other bands from in the 70s in Australia that were of that caliber? Or you think
probably not of that caliber. There was an amazing label called Aztec, which has since sadly gone out of business, that specialized in Australian reissues, and stuff goes all the way back to the 60s. There was a guy named Lobby Lloyd, who was a famous Australian guitar hero. There's a stuff called a band called Black Feather that had an album called At the Mountains of Madness, which is like 1970. So yeah, no, there was absolutely, when you really dig into this stuff, there was a huge late 60s, early 70s Australian rock scene.
Most remember Colored Balls? Have you heard Colored Balls?
Colored Balls, yeah, who I think are actually fantastic. Colored Balls are really heavy. And if you really want to get crazy, one of the things I started getting into after that was there's a South African rock scene that goes all the way back to Freedom's Children and Suck. And, that's like 69 to 70 something. So every country had a scene. It's just whether these things were actually getting out in terms of
money. Yeah, was the whole thing. It's getting a good.
But there's a lot more Australian stuff out there than you'd think. By the way, the Buster Brown, I mentioned before, also were the first band of Mark Evans. So it's Mark Evans and Angry Anderson in the same band.
Absolutely.
All right, we got three more to go.
So we need to move pretty quickly. What do we got left?
Next one is Wishbone Ash, August 1972. I can't go quickly on this one.
Okay.
This is
I guess it's going to be a 2-hour show. All right.
This record is a stone cold classic. Whether we're talking about mainstream metal hard rock, obscure metal hard rock, this is a big one. I believe that this band was one of the greatest British hard rock bands of all time. And this record is a great example as to why. They're kind of like a band in the same class as Status Quo, Slade, huge in the UK, didn't make any waves over here, really. And that's really sad because their catalog is extensive and it's filled with great music. Now, I can't neglect mentioning who invented the twin guitar lead. We could debate for 2 hours on that one, right? But if you ask someone like Steve Harris or Scott Gorham, they're going to tell you that it was Wishbone Ash.
And
I trust those two guys with my life. So it was Wishbone Ash. These two guitarists on the first four Wishbone albums, Ted Turner and Andy Powell, fantastic, tasteful, fluid guitarists. You're not going to hear guitar playing like this from this era outside of this band. These guys were masters, and they worked. The chemistry they had together was absolutely fantastic. This album has Blowing Free on it, which is one of their main claims to fame. If you haven't heard Blowing Free, check it out. I've always described this band to people who didn't know it as folk music played in a hard rock context. The guitar parts are very intricate. They're not always on 11, but they're playing, you know, kind of folky music that maybe was suited more for acoustic guitars, but they're playing it in a hard rock heavy metal context, and it really works well, and it sets them apart from their peers in that way too. It gives them kind of a different slant, and I find it very interesting that Martin Turner is one of my favorite bass players. I'm a bass player myself. He's a phenomenal bass player, not a name you hear. When who's your favorite bass player, top 10 bass players of all time, you never see his name on these lists. It should be. I'm sure he would. Pete Waywood as well, and has. And Horace, I know Horace is a fan. I always hoped that Maiden would cover Blowing Free with all their 50,000 B-sides. I know that Maiden.
Such a massive Wishbone Ash fan.
Yeah, so it always surprised me that they'd never touched that song. They would have really, really rocked the hell out of that song.
They even did Golden Earring, right? Didn't they cover Golden Earring? Yeah.
And Budgie. There are very few bands. Very few bands from that era of UK hard rock that they didn't cover. And it's kind of amazing that they didn't touch a Wishbone Ash song.
Yeah, they did a Stray track, for God's sake.
Right, yeah. Right. So that's always kind of beguiled me there. Check out Argus. Throw Down the Sword, The King Will Come. Those two tunes kind of work as a duo. They're kind of stuck together on the record. They segue beautifully into each other. Every song on this album is outstanding from beginning to end. They deal with medieval themes in their lyrics, not on all their records, but specifically on this one. It's probably some kind of a concept record that is over my head. I'm not from the UK, so I probably missed it. But I really love this album, and I would urge anybody to go out and check it out.
Horace.
So I have a short but fascinating story about Wishbone Ash, which is that all of us, no matter how much music we listen to, there are bands that have fallen between the cracks that we just have not listened to. We've been told for years they were good. You know, for a lot of people that, you know, was Golden Earring. That was not the case with me. I was a huge fan of that band. Wishbone Ash were a band that I had heard the name for years. And this is actually directly ties to Mayo, because I had not really heard anything by Wishbone Ash except maybe three songs off of Argus. and I thought they were pretty good. And this is like, what, 5 years ago, six, maybe less than 5 years ago. And so when they put out, I think it's right behind me over there. It's that massive yellow box, which I'll actually pull down in a second. Right. It's the Wishbone Ash box, which costs close to $300. And they put every freaking album in it, you know, like the entire catalog. And I looked at it and I said, you know what? I could buy what? There it is. I could buy one album. I could buy one album, see if I like it, or I could just go all the fucking way in. And I went all the way in and I bought that box. And Bob was kind of with me through this whole thing. I started listening to all these albums in order. And within 2 years, these guys have actually become one of my all-time favorite bands. And I had not heard a note of them 4 years ago. I've already heard like two or three songs. Now I'm intimately familiar with Wishbone 4, you know, every, and you know, we don't have time. That's a whole, an entire show, because this is a band with incredibly long and complicated history. They've played multiple styles of music. They've gone up, they've gone down, you know, all over the place. But to a lot of people, Argus is their masterpiece.
Hey, are you guys aware of the documentary on the Argus record?
There's a documentary on just the album Argus.
Yeah, I believe. I you know what? I gotta find it again. I started watching it. I don't know if it's a part of the classic album series, but I believe it was on Amazon Prime, and it was great. They had all this old footage of it. I think it was just on the Argus record.
But no, I mean they're
that sounds amazing.
Yeah, you gotta definitely check it out.
They're an amazing band because they, you know. My history with them was that it was the name that I read, and I was always fascinated by how beloved they were by this very wide spectrum of fans. You know, real metal guys in the UK.
Yeah,
you know, that went to Motorhead and Gillan, and you know, these were
you would see patches on the jackets of the British heavy metal bands, say, with Genesis, Rush, and Wishbone Ash. You're like, and then Motorhead.
They have this amazing live album called Live Dates. And, you know, there's a moment on it. I think it's during The King Will Come. There's sort of a martial, you know, thing. And you can hear the entire balcony stamping their feet. It has this very slowly building crescendo. And it's like everybody in the audience knows the rhythm intricately. And they just, you know, they're like banging their feet to it. And it's very electrifying. And you realize that these guys, they just had the audience in the palm of their hands. And the other thing, you know, in addition to what Mayo was saying about the folk aspects. This was a very subtle band. You know, the singing is never, it's almost like, you know, the genius of Phil Maughan, where, you know, he's never screaming at you. He's got this sort of, not relaxed, but kind of cool voice. And that's the thing with Wishbone Ash. Everything is very smooth. But yet it's still extremely rousing. And, you know, there's just like, you know, some of these songs, you listen to them and you're picturing, you know, Welsh, Scottish warriors, you know, going into battle or whatever. So it's just, you know, fantastic. And I would have to say, in terms of a band where all the musicians are phenomenal, this is, and especially on Argus, everybody in that band was just a top player and they play beautifully together. And, you know, I am a big bass player guy. Like I, you know, John Entwistle is my all-time favorite. I love numerous bass players. Martin Turner is absolutely phenomenal. He has this, you know, nimble, acrobatic. To me, he's, you know, he's in the class of a guy like Gary Thayne from Uriah Heep that just never got the due that they deserved because they were that good.
He's very, very fluid player. He's not a show off. He's not showboating. He's singing lead at the same time.
He also has a beautiful singing voice. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. One last thing before we move on. They were very underground, underrated here in the U.S., but I was talking to John Sutherland, and he told me, because he's a big fan, and, you know, of course, he's a huge
fan. They're huge in the U.K.
And they're huge in the U.K., but even in the States, he said he saw them. I believe they headlined the Long Beach Arena, and I think he said it was like a triple bill, Wishbone Ash, Bebop Deluxe, and some other band, but Wishbone was headlining. So I think they were one of those bands, even though they had this real underground, real loyal following out here. But to headline, I mean, you know, Long Beach Arena was up, you know, 13,000.
That would have been probably around the time, you know, Argus was I actually read Andy Powell's autobiography, and they were, you know, like, I think it's a gold record.
I think so.
In the United States. Yeah. So that was the peak of their American.
The prog rock stuff was big. It didn't get, yeah, you know,
they had a couple of albums that were pretty big in America, but they fell off quickly. And then they just continued to do, it's a little bit like, actually it's a more extreme example, but Status Quo are a perfect example. Massive in Britain.
Yep.
Never really did much here.
No one knows.
Okay. But I think Wishbone Ash actually got, they had a couple of years where they did all right, but when it dropped off in America, they practically went back to touring almost exclusively in the UK.
Yeah, I think that was their one and only tour in the States. So.
Yeah, awesome.
Check out that documentary if you can
find Andy
Powell. I'm going to look for that. So they moved to the States for a while, and they recorded a couple of albums in New England, was recorded in New England. But it didn't work out, and they went back home. This is their, what we would probably refer to as their wilderness years. You know, Slade did the same thing. They came over to the States to try to, with Nobody's Fool, to try to conquer the States, and completely failed and went back home, and their audience had moved on.
So did the Desolation Angels.
Right.
On a much smaller level, but yeah. I remember when they came to
LA.
They
moved to LA.
Early 90s, yeah. Yeah.
Next record.
We got Lemmy in LA. That worked out.
Right.
Okay. Next one is Dust's debut album, 1972. You want to go, Horace?
Yeah, I'll do that. I mean, Dust is not too complicated. So Dust is basically, good old fashioned sort of hard rock, very much New York roots, lots of Kiss connections, produced by Kenny Kerner and Richie Wise, who played in Dust. Are the producers of the first two or three Kiss albums, or maybe the first two. I think Bogart steps in for Dress to Kill. Also, that's this is the training ground for the Ramones drummer, was known in the Ramones as Marky Ramone, but his real name is Mark Bell. Is that right? I think that's right.
That's correct.
And this is just a fun, heavy record. And it's not particularly musically complex, but it has this incredible 9-minute song called From a Dry Camel, which is 9.5 minutes, and it's got really great bass playing on it. Who's it on bass? It's Kenny Aronoff, right?
Kenny Aronson,
right, who went on to play with some fairly big bands, if I remember correctly. So there's not much to describe about this record. It's proto metal. It's kind of the definition of proto metal. I don't think it's as good an album as the second one they did, which is called Heart Attack. But I think that 9.5 minute camel pump song kind of makes the record. And also they wrote the book on album covers. It's got the definitive, it's rotting mummified skulls on the, it's like two mummies on the cover rotting. And I was like, Sarcofago would have been proud to have this album cover. And this is like 1970. What is this album? Is it 71? 72. Okay. I would definitely recommend it. The other great thing about Dust is if you want to check them out, you get both albums with fancy liner notes on a CD for $8, fully remastered. And that's the version that I currently have.
What are your thoughts
on this one, Bob? Mayo, sorry.
Well, for students of American hard rock, this very much sounds like Mountain. It comes from that Mountain school of American kind of crunchy riff rock. And the second track, the second track is called Chasing Ladies, and it sounds very much like Mississippi Queen. So that kind of reveals where they're coming from right there. There are mountainisms throughout this record. And of course, Mark Bell, who was, as Horace said, played with the Ramones. If you check out the last song, which is an instrumental called Loose Goose, he plays his ass off on this song. And after listening to, I found this record way after finding the Ramones and listening to 15 Ramones records for 20 years.
Right.
Then I found this record. So when you come to listen to Mark Bell play on Loose Goose, after listening to Marky Ramone play the same thing for hours on end for 15 albums, it's a revelation that this guy had been suppressing his skills for so long in that band. because he really plays his ass off. Kenny Aronson, monster bass player Kenny Aronson, played with Dylan, Rick Derringer, Billy Idol, Joan Jett, Foghat, Billy Squire, New York Dolls. He's the session playing bass player's bass player. He's phenomenal. And this is where he got his beginning here. Horace is correct. From a Dry Camel is the notable track. Almost 10 minutes long. It's really well put together. It's well played. It goes from kind of a Sabbath-y plod to 100 mile an hour Deep Purple jammy section in the middle. It's really interesting. It's fun. It's a fun record. I actually like this better than Harder Attack.
Fair enough.
Because it's a little bit more garagey and a little bit less produced. The second record's a little bit more polished. I mean, we're not really talking about FM airplay here, but I like this one. It's a little more grittier and garagey to me. It's awesome stuff for a young American three-piece band.
I think the drummer was 17 when the album was recorded.
So this also speaks to what was going on. We briefly touched on this before. In New York, there's a lot of this happening with Sir Lord Baltimore and Dust, and probably not just in New York, but again, these records just didn't really stick. That doesn't mean it didn't happen. That doesn't mean that these bands didn't exist. They just didn't. How could you compete with the triumvirate of Sabbath, Purple, and Zeppelin at that time? Even if you were doing what they were doing better, which is debatable, you just couldn't compete with. You were completely operating in the shadow of those three bands. It was kind of hopeless.
That era had a club scene, and you might see Blue Oyster Cult with Sir Lord Baltimore opening. Kiss might be playing, you know, at Coventry, and maybe one of these bands would be somewhere on that bill. But, you know, it was only BOC and Kiss maybe that would get out of there and, you know, become, you know, super, you know, big stars.
And a lot of that, well, you know, with Kiss, it was a combination of a lot of magical things that happened for them.
Yes.
Some great ideas and some good luck. With BOC as well, too, they kind of made their deal with the devil. They signed to Columbia under the contingency that they would become the U.S. Black Sabbath.
They
had to change their sound completely. They used to sound like the Grateful Dead. Now they are trying to sound like Black Sabbath. So there's luck and circumstance. Who knows what's going to make it and what's not.
Absolutely.
But it's tough. There's a lot of this stuff out there. You just got to have to dig a little bit harder for it. And it's easier than ever now with the internet.
Absolutely.
We have one more record left, or is that it?
One more.
Okay.
Randy Holden, Population 2, from 1970. Shall I?
I mean, yeah. Anybody can. I think is this one you're familiar with, Mad Dog?
I'm later on, I got familiar with through the link, really. I knew, I've heard the name a million times, and I just heard some of the stuff, and I never really knew his history.
Randy Holden, to me, is someone that I was very aware of because I'm actually a fairly big, as I know Mayo is, I'm a fairly big Blue Cheer fan, but Blue Cheer had one of the most schizophrenic careers in history with that unbelievable debut and then Outside Inside, which is also, we actually covered earlier in this series, is a fantastic record, undervalued. And then they turn into like sort of like folk rock or something, but they had this crazy album called New Improved, which had, you know, a lot of light, fairly light stuff on it. And then they got this crazy guy named Randy Holden to play lead guitar on two songs on that album, or three songs. And one of them is this amazing track, which I heard, called Fruit and Icebergs, which sounds like, you know, dinosaurs colliding with electric guitars or something. It's just by far the heaviest thing on that record. And I took note of it right away. I was like, this is this Randy Holden cat who only plays on, you know, this one thing. I'm like, this is amazing. And so I had then started reading years later about this solo album that he'd done called Population 2. And I think I've been through five versions of this on, you know, various bootleg CDs, culminating in Holden himself, who's still alive and performing. He actually, right before the pandemic hit, he did a live concert that Scott Carlson of Repulsion actually was at that show. It was a one-off Randy Holden gig. And he's, you know, he looks like Yuli John Roth. He's got like all white hair down to his butt, you know, but he was like, wow, Randy looked and sounded great. And he played almost the entire Population 2 record. But this album is just, it's psychedelic rock, but really heavy. And Holden has this phenomenal guitar tone. And it's just really unique. It's like, it just, somebody beamed this one in from outer space. It reminds me a little of like the sort of, you know, more esoteric Yuli Roth stuff when he's getting his Hendrix vibe on. Because I'm also getting a little bit of the Hendrix stuff from Randy. But now maybe Mayo knows. What is the story on this? Was it recorded with two musicians or was it all done by Holden? Or for years it was like almost impossible to figure out who played on the record.
They were a duo. It was Randy Holden and his drummer. The drummer also played keyboards.
Right.
Which I'd like to see that live, but but it was a duo. I think that this was probably, in my opinion, for students of the genre here, this is the most significant record on our list.
This
record really bridges the gap between what Hendrix and Cream and the 60s proto metal guys were doing and what the more riff-centric stuff that Sabbath and Blue Cheer and those kinds of bands. It's right in the middle. It's got Hendrixisms, psych, tons of psych, but it's also very riff-based, which was the big leap, right, from psychedelic music, acid rock. Suddenly there are riffs, and now we're talking about heavy metal. This is like right in between there, right in that magic spot. You can tell why that he was hired by Blue Cheer to replace Lee Stevens, because there's some whammy, overdriven craziness on the record. And you say, yes, okay, this is the perfect guy to join Blue Cheer. But then, as Horace said, when you hear the record that he's on, it's pretty weak. He quit during the recording of New and Improved, because the band wanted to go in that kind of almost country rock sort of direction that dominates that record. So after the two songs that he contributed, he left the band. And this was his next project. So this is what he really wanted to do with Blue Cheer. And boy, that would have been amazing if he could have done Population 2 stuff with Blue Cheer.
In that
context. Yeah. I mean, the world probably would have cracked in half. I think this is a significantly important record. And I didn't hear this until 2008 when one of the proper reissues was released.
What was the deal with him? Because, I mean, now you hear about him, of this kind of legendary guitar player. Was it so underground? Was it the label? Or was, because, you know, Blue Cheer were relatively, you know, before him, the debut was so huge. You would think his name... you know, now I hear a lot of people talk about him. And
I think Holden is one of these, you know, I keep coming back to Yuli John Roth, because I think they're very kindred souls in their sort of outlook. And, you know, I think Holden was, you know, very much part of the counterculture scene, sort of went through life to his own, you know, the beat of his own drummer. And he kind of disappeared. I mean, for decades. Who knows? I feel like maybe he went to an ashram, searching for enlightenment somewhere. I don't know. But the guy all but disappeared after the Population 2 record. He didn't join another band that I know of.
From what I've read, he had label issues. He sunk a lot of his own money into the Population 2 project.
Yeah.
And there were problems with the label and the release of the record, which is why it's been popping up in bootleg versions forever, because the rights are kind of nebulous. Mm-hmm. And he went bankrupt. He declared bankruptcy and lost all of his gear and didn't play a note of music for over 20 years.
And that was 1970 that was released too, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
That would have been pretty groundbreaking if it had.
Finally, I guess he got some Japanese financing and he did an album called Guitar God. And I think that's like 2000. Now we're talking 2008. And, you know, God bless the Japanese. They saved a lot of guys that you know, had Absolutely. Fallen into, you know, been forgotten. That was an interesting Japanese label that was also putting out sort of almost bootleg quality blue cheer concerts, but paying the members. So fair props to that.
It's a similar story to what happened with Frank Marino is the same situation where he was done.
Right.
And, you know, when the internet really started to become a force, people were reaching out to him saying, I want to start a website for you.
Right.
And he's like, why would anybody want to do that? Nobody knows who I am. And as the World Wide Web opens up and the universe is exposed, oh, I have a fan base. I didn't know. Same thing with Holden. People were urging him, you got to play. You got to record. We will finance it. And it took a little convincing for both of these guys.
Yeah.
God bless them.
And, you know,
that's why he came back.
I'll ask Scott about this, but that's why I understand it. That show in LA was sold out. You know, people were like, oh my God, you're seeing Randy Holden? That's so unbelievably cool. How is that even happening? And he was like, yeah, no, Randy Holden's playing at the Troubadour or whatever it was. And I guess he has his equipment now. So, I mean, honestly, sometimes these stories just are heartbreaking to me because I think of all this great music that we could have had if these guys hadn't been, you know, ripped off by unscrupulous labels and managers and everybody else that ripped these guys off. And it sounds like somebody did a real number on Randy Holden. But he's still with us. And as far as I know, he's still working. He's probably more active now than he was 15 years ago. But for people that are into this sound, absolutely check out Population 2. And now it has a completely legitimate reissue on a label called Riding Easy Records. And if you know, Google the name of the album, you can get it on Bandcamp. You can get it all over the internet. You can order it direct from the label. And you'll actually be giving Randy the money so you can feel good about it. I always tell people, if you have any way to support musicians so that they actually get the money, by all means do that. Bandcamp does that, and label buying direct from the label does that. But so Population 2, and you can buy it on vinyl too. They have made the vinyl record and the CD available.
All right. Well, we're about 100 or an hour 40 minutes in. Should we go ahead and end this thing? I know, Bob, you got some websites, the mayonnaise. So before we end, let
everybody do their plugs. We'll start.
Okay.
There
you go. My blog is called Mayonnaise, one word, and it's on WordPress. My old band's reissuing its back catalog. My band's name was Wargasm. We're on Bandcamp, and you can find me on Facebook.
All right.
I have my own very fledgling little YouTube channel. It's called Rock and a Hard Place. I only have a few videos up, but we have some Blue Easter Cult stuff. I'll definitely be adding more content on that. So you can find that by looking for Horace Cordier, HoraceCordier, Rock and a Hard Place. That's the YouTube channel. I also write for Ian Jane's website, which is known as Rock Shop Pop. I do album reviews, a little bit more recent stuff. Like the last thing I reviewed was the newest Sodom album. And so that's really it for me. And, you know, I'm all over Facebook. You usually see me commenting on Monty Connor's threads or Mad Dog's threads, or we're all over everybody's stuff, or Pop Off on Facebook.
All right. Well, thank you again, man. Always great having you guys on. We might have to do a part four very soon. We'll have to think
about part four. And also, I'm sure Mayo's the same. I'm willing to jump in on any other group. And, you know, I'm looking at your Raven t-shirt and I'm like, wow, I'd love to be talking about the new wave of British heavy metal.
We could do that too. I just talked to John earlier, actually. So,
John Gallagher?
John Gallagher, yeah. And we're still working on the Marty Friedman thing. He says when the record comes out, we'll try to set something up there.
Well, Marty is, you know, one of those guys. I love Marty. And I don't know a single person that has ever said a bad word about Marty. Apparently,
he's nicest guy you could
sweetest be. Guy in the business.
Both him and Jason Becker. Yep. Absolutely. Well, cool. Again, the Shockwave Skull Sessions. We're now at cmspn.com. It's our new podcast network. Makes it a lot easier to subscribe and get to the new episodes because we had switched over to Anchor. So check us out there. And with that said, man, both Bob Mayo and Horace, thank you so much for being a part of this, man. And we will
anytime, Bob.
Posted.
Anytime.
All right, guys.
Thanks, guys. Take care. Have Stay safe.
Thank you for listening to the Shockwave Skull Sessions podcast. Subscribe and listen to all episodes by going to our pages on iTunes, Spreaker, YouTube, Spotify, and more. You can listen to all of their episodes and access up-to-date information and news on the Shockwave Skull Sessions podcast by going to our website at www.shockwaveskullsessions.com. Email all comments, questions, and suggestions to shockwaveskullsessions@gmail.com.